about the development plans themselves, what type of housing there's going to be?
My understanding is that there will be some kind of retail on the lower floor with some parking, and then low-income housing. It was what we were trying to avoid was market-rate housing, because we felt that was probably not compatible with our dining hall, that there would be instant complaints about sort of our business of feeding the poor. And it was very important to the parish that the housing be available for people who work but don't make a lot of money. So that's our target audience. And I think there are a lot of studios they're putting in and some one bedrooms for sort of worker housing.
St. Francis of Assisi Park has been a popular site for all walks of life for a number of years. Housing in Portland is a difficult issue to address, but one thing that's certain is the people who don't have a house to go to will surely miss this park. For KBOO News, I'm Henry Leisha.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Enemigo Imperialismo, Enemy Imperialism, a bilingual community art exhibit that explores the dimensions of imperialism in the world today. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. Artists around the world have responded to violence with work that questions the legitimacy of the state and empire. Enemigo Imperialismo points to one of our common targets in the fight for global justice and invites us to reflect on power, resistance, and self-determination. Again, that's Enemigo Imperialismo. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. The show will be up until September 25th. More information can be found at kwoo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the White Bear Polar Tundra album release show on Saturday, September 6th at 9 p.m. Opening bands include The Great Hiatum and Snow Roller. White Bear Polar Tundra stands for Environmental Progress with a Conscientious DIY Ethic, and their debut album, Strikes Back, is their effort to create progressive, head-turning music. This show is playing at Alhambra Theater, located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information about this KBOO co-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess of Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
Good evening, dearest listeners. Welcome to Out Loud here on KBOO. Tonight we have a great program. We're going to chat in a little bit with KBOO's own Boston. He's been working in the engineering room for all of these months with us. We're going to get a chance to talk on the radio. A little bit later, we're going to talk with Stephen Fiala. He's with the Oregon Health Authority, and he's co-author of a study that was just published this month by the Center for Disease Control, the federal CDC, on sexual orientation and chronic conditions, health factors, and health practices here in Oregon. It's a study based here in Oregon. We're going to hear a little bit of Blood Orange to kick things off, and we'll be back shortly. Thank you so much, dear listeners, here on Out Loud. Thanks for being here on Out Loud. That was Blood Orange. The song is Shamake. It's got an incredibly sweet music video. Check it out online. I want to let you know about something that's happening in just about 2 months. I organize a yearly thriller dance. Yes, that sounds a little strange, but it's a simultaneous worldwide thriller dance. And we teach you the dance. And actually, a couple of hundred people get together every year in their zombie costumes and zombie makeup and dance together in public here in Portland. And it happens around the world at the same time, all over the place. There's great videos on YouTube of what's now the last 7 years that we've done this. This year will be 8. And all sorts of great performances around the world. In particular, if you look for Camus, they do these great themed ones. They have a small contingent of dancers, so they can really concentrate on picking one theme and have everybody dress and dance around that. Anyway, the reason I bring it up, it's a fundraiser for SMRC, Portland's Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, queer teen drop-in center here in Portland that does amazing work and has for a long time. So look for us, thrilltheworld.portland on Facebook, I mean. And we have a website that we don't update very often. But we will eventually post information about what's happening. And we don't have a location picked yet, although I have something in mind in the city. And we start practices in late September. So we practice for about 4 weeks. You can join our practices or you can learn the dance from instructional videos online. The dance is reconfigured to fill the whole song, so it's a fair amount of work, and we invite you to get started early. Please find us on Facebook, thrilltheworld.portland. Another thing is SMRC is potentially going through some changes. They're in discussion about where they're going to go in the future. And there's a space on Facebook for adult allies of SMRC to have their own conversation about what they'd like to do to support the youth. So if you just pop in your search box on Facebook, SMRC, S-M-Y-R-C, support, SMRC support, you can join that conversation and start to get a feel for what's happening and how we, the community, the adults in the community, can support the SMRC youth. We're in a chat for a while tonight with Boston. They are one of the Out Loud volunteers, and we're very excited.
Hello.
Hello. Boston is part of the KBOO Youth Collective, is that right?
Not anymore. Today I sent in my notice. I'm breaking up with the Youth Collective.
So you're Out Loud's only, is that right?
Yes.
Wonderful.
I'm 100% Out Loud's.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. We've had the incredible honor of having you help us with these shows for a long time, but we haven't had you. I haven't had you on the air for conversation.
Yeah, I don't know. I push the buttons and I draw pictures while I push the buttons and listen to people talk. I don't know. I do a lot of visual art and I'm kind of active in the queer community too.
What sort of activities are you engaged in?
Just looking fly and being queer. My two main occupations.
So I promised Boston a conversation that would kick off around the theme of gentrification. And I didn't get a chance to share with Boston this article. Maybe you know a little bit about it, maybe you don't. But it's based on a new book. It's called There Goes the Gayborhood. And it's by a gentleman named Amin Ghaziani. And this, I'm reading from an article in The New Yorker by Elizabeth Greenspan that ran earlier this month. Greenspan quotes Nate Silver, the famous statistician, pop statistician. Mm-hmm. No matter how correct he is about predicting everything in the world, he still presents as statistics as pop culture, you know. Mm-hmm. But the article quotes him in an older interview with Out magazine as saying, "To my friends, I'm kind of sexually gay, but ethnically straight." Mm-hmm. And then Greenspan, the author of this article, goes on to have a discussion with Ghaziani about his book and about how gays and lesbians are less likely to live in these sort of gay-centric gayborhoods, as this book is calling them. And populations are not only moving to different parts of urban areas, out to the suburbs, especially according to this article, if gay lesbian couples have children, they're more likely to move to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. There's also, developing numbers of folks who are gay or lesbian or bisexual living outside of your traditional cities and states. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we would call red states or more conservative states, there's developing populations. Mm-hmm. Also quoted in this article is a discussion in the book about how lesbians, because they have lower incomes, are often sort of some of the first folks to gentrify poorer neighborhoods. And one woman is interviewed as expressing resentment that gay men with their higher incomes then come after lesbians have begun to improve. Let's air quote that a neighborhood. Not a lot of sense of the irony of saying that. Of not recognizing, you know, that there was presumably somebody in these neighborhoods before lesbians started showing up. But so the book is called There Goes the Gayborhood. And, I remember, I don't know, maybe it was a decade or so ago, that in Portland there was a sort of a robust discussion around should there be a queer neighborhood or should there be at least be a neighborhood where a lot of gay folks don't end up living there, but the bars would be centered the way that they were centered on Stark Street downtown. Some area that was clearly identifiable as gay, something like Boys Town or Castro. And it was a robust discussion. Of course, you know, there was no right or wrong answer to it, and it went where it went. But then somebody today suggested online, I was reading a Facebook stream, and this person suggested that that gay folks might create a gayborhood, a gay enclave in Chinatown, in Old Town Chinatown. And what was...
It's interesting.
Well, it was interesting because not a lot of folks responded to the what this person's point was, that there should be some sort of gay enclave in the city. That didn't seem to interest people. There didn't seem to be a lot of verve. What they responded to was the suggestion that whatever's happening in Chinatown right now isn't.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's a really interesting, like, cultural exchange between queer communities and communities of color, and where they intersect is really interesting. And also, I think that the gay population in Portland, a lot of them are white and cis, and I don't know that it's their responsibility to gentrify places like Chinatown or places where, you know, like they have the advantage being the racial privilege. So I think it's really interesting how the communities cross. It kind of reminds me of the way, like, 80s LA was gentrified, in the art communities, the populations with the, like, highest AIDS breakouts among queer communities, like, experienced this really violent gentrification of their art and slowly became, like, whiter and straighter in those communities.
Well, there's a fascinating woman, Sarah Schulman. She's a Jewish lesbian. She was a novelist in the 90s, has switched to writing primarily nonfiction. And she wrote a book just a few years ago. Actually, she's interesting for a couple of points. But mm-hmm. but one is she wrote a book called Gentrification of the Mind. Mm-hmm. And it's a takeoff on all sorts of different notions of privilege and different experiences. And she lives in New York, and she, her starting point is the West Village when AIDS swept through and killed a lot of people. There was physically space There's physically empty space for people to come in, and she has no problem labeling it gentrification to change the face of these neighborhoods. And in particular, I think one of the hardest parts of gentrification is that it's very hard to culturally integrate a new group of folks moving to a community. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, and that was something that she talked about experiencing, was that, you know, folks came in and they just emptied out these apartments. They just threw everything these folks who died owned in dumpsters, and they just, you know, built their own lives and they weren't interested in the folks around them. Mm-hmm. Which reminds me of something I read in the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Yes, once a week I try to check in with the journal. And they were talking about Ferguson in Missouri, and there was a really interesting note that surveys indicate that for white people, racial integration consists of, on average, in their minds, what white people generally consider to be acceptable integration and a positive experience is a community that's 90% white and 10% black. Mm-hmm. And for black folks interviewed in these studies, it was about 50-50, 50% white mm-hmm. folks and 50% black folks living in a neighborhood was what black folks considered to be integration.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah, definitely. Like, I feel like gentrification can be one of the most visually, just like blatant ways, or like, blatant presentations of racial privilege. You see development in the eyes of like white upper middle class people just kind of like litter these or like grow from the inside out in these like communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only type of development that's accepted as development, where oftentimes it's not social development; it's like only economic development. That's, I think it's very interesting.
That is an excellent point. And as a longtime resident of Inner North Northeast, I think that's exactly how I think I would characterize development in the last 20 years as economic development and not cultural or social. Not,
yeah, exactly.
And I had a neighbor I lived around the corner from for over a decade. And she was an older woman who had lived in the neighborhood for many years. Her parents lived there. And she's one of the things she told me was, you know, that she's got these, you know, all these new folks are moving to the neighborhood and they don't bother to say hello to her. They simply do not. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm not interested in being friends with people, my neighbors. Like, that's not what I need from them. I'm not interested in in-depth conversations. You know, I'll ask her help if I need it. But to be ignored completely is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough challenge to teach people that some other people exist.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also tough, like, yeah, this neighborhood is cheaper, and yeah, it's easier for you to live here, but is it appropriate for you to come here? Or, like, is it, not come here, but, like, is it appropriate for you to mark this place as your own and to start, like, erasing this culture? And, like, that's like, a tough situation with the like Chinatown idea, is that appropriate at all? Like, both sides face discrimination, but I feel like racial, like financial privilege kind of trumps the queer like aspect of that. It makes it so that these are white people with more money coming here to form their community where this community already stands.
It's true.
And it's like such a tough situation.
Well, in Chinatown especially, you know, it's such a hub of services for houseless folks.
Mm-hmm.
So really what you're saying is, you know, they don't need to be here.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, you know, that's, to me, it's reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that communicating it to people and doing it with money, and in the sense that you're, you know, it's not even accidental, but it would be on purpose.
Yeah,
and it would be to celebrate your own needs. Not that accidental gentrification, so to speak, would be any more acceptable or less painful. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it just like this is kind of a cop out response or sentence or whatever. Like, I think just like an open dialogue is honestly like what that type of situation needs, because I think like people are aware when they move into communities of color, like, but they don't like, I don't know, we don't like talk about that. Like, I mean, we talk about it like this is a problem that happens, but it's not like wow, like I don't think my living situation now and like the places I choose to frequent or support in their gentrification, like I don't think my support of these places is appropriate, like maybe I should stop like contributing to gentrification. Like, I feel like that kind of conversation is more difficult and less frequent.
Well, one of the things that I've experienced in the conversations about gentrification, especially recently, one thing that's come up is folks, white folks who move into the neighborhood around me. One of the things some of them say is, I moved into this neighborhood because it's diverse.
Yeah,
but that's sort of where it seems that's where they think their sense of responsibility ends.
Oh yeah, exactly.
And what I hear in that is that they're saying that that they bought themselves neighbors of color, sort of as set pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
In their lives,
they bought themselves the credibility as people who are socially conscious.
I think that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. I've learned a lot of things that I, I've heard a lot of things that I wish I didn't hear, and I have a somewhat more of a sense of how much of a challenge it is. And I think that attitude really reflects that people's ideas about how to be in the world come down to money. You know, it comes down to wealth and power based in wealth and privilege to a degree that they're not at all capable of recognizing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's super challenging. I mean, how do we have those conversations between any people who are on, let's say opposite sides of a power divide in a community?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it's definitely a... The money aspect makes it sort of a taboo thing, along with the aspect of race. And it's like when you present somebody's decision to gentrify as problematic, like their defensive reaction to that is totally inappropriate, and like it happens. Like, it's hard to address somebody's like financial decision, like rented a house here, like you're just contributing to this problem. Like,
do you think Portland's better off for not having a gay enclave? That we live in a community where gay folks are, gay and lesbian folks are sort of more integrated, perhaps.
I feel like intentionally setting out to gentrify or claim a certain neighborhood where things might be cheaper, where like people of color already live, I think that is like the intention there is the wrong part. Like, I don't think communities like vibrant, strong communities that visually present themselves like in a certain place are usually, I don't know that they're in intentional community. I don't know that people, this is mine, like we're coming here. I don't know that that happens. So I don't know. I think it would be better for the queer people to be like, like, this is where we hang out, or like, I don't know, this is like, this is where people like to be. This isn't, and this isn't a place where we're putting people, other people, at a disadvantage.
That's for certain. Well, we're here as on Out Loud to help foster community, even if it's electronic and through the radio waves. Let us know how we're doing, always. 503-231-8187. We're going to hear a track from Love and Spoonful. This is probably the last time I'll get to play this song this year, unironically. And then we're going to come back and talk about health disparities, how we can be healthier members of a queer community. We're here on Out Loud. Thank you so much, Boston.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Shadow in the city, all around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. Cool town, meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat, looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Just like the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.
Welcome back to Out Loud, dearest listeners. We have Stephen Fiala with the Oregon Health Authority here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about a paper that some folks at the Oregon Health Authority, including Stephen, constructed and published just this month in the Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
Yes.
I think people don't know that it's...
Yes, prevention is key.
In one of their journals, I suppose they must have many journals, and this is just one.
Well, this is, of course, the most important one, because we're in it. So,
tell us a bit about who you are, Stephen.
Sure. So my name is Stephen Fiala, and I'm a research analyst for Oregon's Public Health Division. And
you worked on this great study.
Yes. So as a division and as a section, we kind of realized that we didn't know a lot about the health and health behaviors of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. And in Oregon, we've actually been collecting survey data on the LGB population since 2003. It's been on our big adult survey that we ask of Oregonians to look at things like chronic conditions, like heart disease and stroke. We look at factors that will eventually lead to chronic conditions like tobacco use, binge drinking, obesity, and then a few screening practices or protective health practices like flu immunizations and HIV testing. So those are the kinds of topic areas that we ask on this survey. And we realized we didn't know a lot about the LGBT population. We've been collecting these data, and so we underwent this effort to learn more about the health and health practices of this population that we're interested in. So that was kind of the impetus for the study.
Fabulous. Now, how many folks are included in the study? What does that look like?
How many people worked on the study itself, or how many Oregonians were?
How many Oregonians were did you speak with?
Yeah, so we combined the surveys conducted annually among Oregonians, and because the LGBT folks are a smaller proportion of the overall population, we combined multiple years of data. So this represents 2005 through 2008, and it included 16,475 men and 26,271 women. And it's kind of interesting because of those men and women, 1.6% reported being gay, 0.7% reported being bi. For women, 1.3% reported being lesbian, and 1.2% reported being bi. And so
to slow that down, it was roughly similar in numbers who identified as gay and bisexual or lesbian and bisexual, but a higher percentage of gay. A higher percentage of women who responded as lesbian or bisexual identified as bisexual than the percentage of gay and bisexual men who identified as bisexual. It was a notable difference.
Yeah.
All right. That's pretty interesting. So it did also, that means that you also got, you also had a noteworthy contingent of folks who identify as bisexual to look at their health practices.
Yeah, that was one of the benefits of combining the years and including so many years of the data is that we were able to separate out lesbian women, gay men from bisexual men and women who self-identify that way. A lot of previous studies have lumped these groups together and reported it. But as you'll see in the paper, health disparities, chronic diseases, and the risk factors are pretty different between bisexual men and women and lesbian gay men.
Well, let's dig right into that, and let's put it in the frame of taking a look at the health of bisexuals, both men and women, you know, compared to gay men and lesbian women.
So for the study itself, the group that we were comparing bisexual men and women and gay men, lesbian women to were actually heterosexual or straight men and women. So that was kind of the comparison group. And I think the most notable things to me were in that factors that affect health that lead to chronic disease later on down the line. The higher rates of cigarette smoking among bisexual women, bisexual men, or bisexual, men and lesbian women, the higher rates of binge drinking across the groups, and the higher rates of obesity among bisexual women and lesbian women. I think those disparities are significant. And we're really caught our eye and our attention because they're the number one, two, and three top preventable causes of death. And so seeing that, I'm referring to the paper really quick. I know it should all be stored in my head, but it's not.
No, my favorite radio host ever, Melvin Bragg, always, every radio program he does, he makes reference to the notes that he brought in.
Yeah.
So it's good.
Okay, good. So I'm in good company. Yes. Yeah, so to note that bisexual men are nearly twice as likely to smoke cigarettes as heterosexuals, and bisexual women are nearly three times more likely, lesbian women nearly twice as likely to smoke cigarettes compared to heterosexual women. So noting the significant disparities in those chronic disease risk factors was really interesting to our group.
Let's talk a little bit about why that might be. I mean, you know, there's no shortage of speculation about what creates an environment in which gays, lesbian, bisexual, trans folk engage in these more damaging behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm. In the paper, we talk about the idea that chronic stress or minority stress, just the everyday stress experienced by people in the LGBT community through the, you know, institutionalized discrimination that we experience every day, likely contributes to some of these unhealthy behaviors, maybe as a coping mechanism for this. So that was one of the proposed reasons that we had. So just the way in which our society is set up that that discriminates on a daily basis against LGBT people, and living in that environment every single day, and experiencing that stress and potentially an outlet for that stress being one of these unhealthy coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. And we think of ourselves as living in this mellow semi paradise out here,
yeah.
But as this book I mentioned earlier, There Goes the Gayborhood, suggests, there's, you know, there are more gay and lesbian folks intentionally living in places that are considered to be more conservative, mm-hmm. Than here, and one only wonders what their experience is like. However, I think I understand it that this kind of study that you co-wrote with folks at the Oregon Health Authority is unusual. This kind of data isn't yet being collected and collated regularly in many places. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, one thing that we like to note, in the Institute of Medicine released a report on the health of LGBT people. And one of the key messages in that report was that there is this serious gap in the systematic collection of data related to the health of LGBT people. And so, yeah, we were ahead of the game in a way as a state in adding this to our population-based survey instruments to collect the health-related data. These populations, we added it to our survey in 2003, which was a little bit ahead of its time. And then also just to take the time to actually analyze and systematically look at this data. A lot of people are collecting it, and then it sits there, either because of limited resources or capacity. But I think that's another important thing to note, is just taking the time to collect as well as analyze and translate these data. It's really important.
What made the Oregon Health Authority decide to take the time and effort to put this data together and publish it? I mean, sort of among, you know, obviously there are many competing priorities when it comes to health concerns and, you know, where folks can put energy and work into.
Mm-hmm. I think we have always had the disadvantaged populations at the top of our minds, so LGBT community, communities of color. I think maybe it was just a capacity issue. Having another person on staff on board, I was the last person to enter into this study, and maybe just that was the tipping point for this. And, yeah.
Stephen, and this is my fault, we skipped over explaining what the Oregon Health Authority actually is.
Yeah, so I'm located in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority, and the Public Health Division is concerned with the health of the entire community. So we like to note that about 90% of the influencers of health occur outside the doctor's office, in the places where we live, work, learn, and play. And so the Public Health Division is charged with implementing programs and policies that that affect these places and make them easier for people to make the healthy choices. So concerned Wonderful. With that population-wide health. Yeah.
Wonderful. So let's go back to the survey itself and the results you've put together and published this month. I'd like to take a look at the section that you have, chronic conditions and health limitations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you talk with us about some of what you learned there?
Sure. So, yeah. So in terms of chronic conditions, we found that bisexual men were significantly more likely to have a disability that limits activities compared to heterosexual men. Lesbian women were significantly more likely to have been diagnosed with arthritis and to also have a disability compared to heterosexual women. And then bisexual women were significantly more likely to have poor mental or physical health, asthma, a disability that limits activities as well. So, and then we didn't find any significant differences for the chronic conditions and health limitations for gay men.
So that's compared to?
Compared to heterosexual men. Yeah. So all of these comparisons are using heterosexual men and women as kind of the reference.
And as far as protective health practices?
Mm-hmm. So for protective health practices, so gay men were significantly more likely to receive an influenza immunization, as well as ever be tested for HIV. Bisexual men were significantly more likely to ever be tested for HIV compared to heterosexual men. And then compared to heterosexual women, lesbian women were significantly less likely to have had their teeth checked in the past 12 months to have an oral exam. And then bisexual women were significantly less likely to have a health checkup in general in the last 2 years, to have had their teeth cleaned in the past 12 months. But they were more likely to be tested for HIV. So,
how much can we speculate on what the implications are for Oregonians in the results that are here, especially in terms of how we respond to, let's say, folks engaging in higher risk behavior, mm-hmm. Who are gay and lesbian compared to, and bisexual compared to the heterosexual population? Obviously, there are things we can do individually, just as people. There are also things that we can do as a community or as communities to encourage different and healthier practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the primary functions of the state public health division and the chronic disease section in particular is to make sure we're collecting these data to kind of take that first step and do the assessment and do the collection of these data so that we can identify at a population level that these problems do exist. You had referred to having stories and anecdotes about risk behaviors or certain behaviors among the LGBT population. And so one of the first steps we take is to collect the data and to kind of almost validate or confirm some of the anecdotes with the population level data. And then the next step is to provide these data, provide information on these disparities that do exist. In our case, to a lot of the local public health divisions that we work with closely, other public health advocates that are also working on health equity issues. So I think one of our primary roles is to continue collecting and disseminating this information for some of the local organizations to move forward with some of the work they're doing.
On a more personal note, what would you like to see happen? How would you like to see communities respond to the information presented here? Or let me rephrase that. What do you think would be the most effective kinds of responses that can come out of public health studies such as these?
Mm-hmm. I kind of like to think of this as arming people with more than just the story. The stories are very important and very compelling in telling the story of health disparities and health inequities that are occurring in a lot of disadvantaged populations, targeted populations like the LGBT community. So I like to think of data and this publication hopefully arming public health advocates with these really tangible data that tell a story. I mean, I hope that people are able to take this and move forward with the work they're doing and really bring life to the story that we tried to write in this single article. But I mean, if you've read many journal articles, they don't really come to life on their own. Hopefully you haven't read many journal articles, but so I'm hoping that we can provide these data to our local partners so that they can bring life to these stories and move the really important work forward.
Tomorrow, hopefully, or when I get caught up on my life, which maybe it'll be next week. Maybe I'll use Labor Day for that. I'll link this, the online version of this article on our Facebook, KBOO Out Loud. I didn't make a note, but I meant to make a note to do that. So that folks can take a look at this, and that you don't feel like you have to memorize this, everything we've talked about and be quizzed on it later, but you can read this at your own leisure, and get a sense for, what respondents had to say about their health, or health practices, and their health challenges. So, yeah. So does this sort of study inform funding?
I would hope so. Yes.
Well, okay, let me turn that question around.
That is way past my pay grade. Make comments on funding. I am a mere research analyst.
Well, let me turn that around.
Okay.
And I won't phrase this as a question, but just more of a comment. It's my hope that folks can take information like this and not only have discussions in their community, but also advocate for resources to be directed, and a lot of them are going to be public resources towards addressing these very issues. And what that looks like, I mean, I think it changes, you know, from subject to subject, or I hate to use the word fight, but whatever you're fighting for, you know, of course, there's only so much. There's only so much money and time to go around, so we have to make decisions about where to put those kinds of energy. But it is good for us to start to have something that we can really grapple with, mm-hmm. and some numbers, and something we can turn back, have in hand and turn back to those places who provide us with healthcare and with resource allocations in healthcare, health provision, and say, here are the things that you need to be thinking about. And in some ways, that's, we can all do that, not all, but, you know, we can try to do that for ourselves. But we also, as a community, we can also, turn to the state, and we can turn to insurers, and we can turn to hospitals and clinics and say, here are the things that perhaps you don't know, or perhaps you don't want to know, but now you do know. So that there's real value in putting this data together and putting it out in the public realm for us to use.
Yeah. Great.
So thank you for that. Does this particular survey continue?
Yes. Yeah, this survey is an annual survey, and we're gearing up to do it again. And so hopefully soon we'll be able to do this same analysis and provide some updated data, see how things have changed over time, and release it again. Maybe I'll be back here in a couple of years.
Fabulous. One thing I did note in here was that cell phones were a challenge. Is that still something that researchers have to grapple with? I mean, we see it a lot when it comes to surveys. Is there some, you know, is that a challenge that that researchers or surveyors are coming to terms with?
Yeah. In this particular article, so the data are from 2005 through 2008, and it includes only landline telephones at that time. But in Oregon since 2010, for this particular survey, we started including cell phones. So the data moving forward that will be published will include both landlines and cell phones, which is great because we're going to get a more accurate representation of the population. Especially with cell phones, it tends to be the younger population.
Indeed.
And the LGBT population in particular tends to be younger overall than the heterosexual population. So,
wonderful. Stephen, thanks so very much. Boston is going to queue up a track for us, a little bit of music to end the show. Stephen, thanks so much for the work you're doing and for publishing this study with your coworkers at the Oregon Health Authority. And thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We are grateful. We are Out Loud. Coming up next is Hard Knock Radio. It's going to be a great show. And we'll be back next Tuesday at 6 p.m. We will link the survey from the Oregon Health Authority on our Facebook. Again, that's KBOO Out Loud on Facebook. And we'll see you again next Tuesday.
Listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. And as always, you can hear us at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the White Bear Polar Tundra album release show on Saturday, September 6th at 9 p.m. Opening bands include The Great Hiatum and Snow Roller. White Bear Polar Tundra stands for environmental progress with a conscientious DIY ethic, and their debut album, Strikes Back, is their effort to create progressive, head-turning music. This show is playing at Alhambra Theater, located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information about this KBOO co-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Last. Not only for black people, but for all people.
This is Dan